Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Hi, I'm Paul Listick, and welcome to Behind the Curtain. And welcome to the podcast, everybody. We're going to go behind the curtain of the Chicago mayoral race this week. We're going to sort of kick off our candidate look with, we'll talk to all the candidates as time goes on, but we're going to start with somebody who's getting a lot of attention in this race. We'll understand why as we continue on. Lori Lightfoot has garnered a lot of attention, and a lot of people have said, keep your eye on her because she is the one to watch in this upcoming election. We're going to find out. We're going to find out all about her background, her work with the police board, all sorts of things. So let's just get into it, and let me welcome Lori Lightfoot to the podcast. Lori, welcome.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be with you.
And let's start by, not everybody knows who you are, right? So let's begin, if we would, with you. Feel free to, you know, this is not an attack interview. None of these mayoral interviews are going to be attacked. This is your chance to put out your policies, your plans. Let's start with your background for folks to get more familiar with who you are.
Sure. I've lived in the city for almost 32 years. It'll be 32 years in a couple weeks. And I came here on a scholarship to attend the University of Chicago Law School. I grew up in a small town in Ohio about 60 miles south of Cleveland. At the time that I was growing up there, it was a small steel town and fairly segregated at the time. I'm the youngest of my parents' four children, and my parents grew up in the 1920s in the segregated South, my father in Arkansas and my mother in Alabama. And they both moved with their respective families to kind of escape the terrible conditions in the South at that time. They met when they were in their late teens at an Urban League dance, got married. But early on in their marriage, my father became tragically ill. One of his jobs was to stoke a coal furnace at the local YMCA, and coming in and out of that extreme heat into the cold, he caught pneumonia that turned into a much more serious illness, and he was in a coma for almost a year. Doctors had given him up for dead, but luckily he survived. But he came out of that experience with total hearing loss. So imagine in the 1950s, a young black man, high school degree, and now has a profound disability. I share that story with your listeners because watching my parents struggle their entire lives as they did, really living from paycheck to paycheck, my father always had at least two jobs, if not three jobs. He worked in a factory, and he did janitor work, and then, frankly, was the local barber for a lot of the black families in our town. And my mother also worked in low-wage jobs her entire working career in mental health, mental institutions, nursing homes, and then later as a home health care aide. So I know a lot about what it feels like to struggle, to be left out, and frankly, to be denied opportunities solely on the basis of your race. So in this campaign, when I talk about things like the need to have equity and inclusion as our North Stars in thinking about policy, the issues of social justice, I know that as a kid who was denied opportunity solely because of my race. And it's frankly been my great fortune to be a lawyer and be an advocate for a lot of different causes that are important to me, not the least of which is making sure that minority and women have full access to voting rights, and to be able to choose legislators who are responsive to their needs. I've been a federal prosecutor, to be sure, but I've also represented poor defendants in criminal court cases. So I've tried to use the benefits that I've had over the course of my lifetime to really be a voice and an advocate for people whose voices need to be heard and uplifted.
And by the way, so I know you talked about your work on the defense. You, just to be kind of full circle here, you were also an assistant U.S. attorney, right? So you handled the prosecution of various criminal drug cases, political corruption, that kind of thing, and others.
Yes, I did. I worked as an assistant U.S. attorney here in the U.S. Attorney's Office for about a little over 6 years. Did a lot of different trials, a lot of different cases, from drug cases, violent crime, public corruption, prosecuted police officers. So I really had that kind of full range of experience in that job. And then I went on to serve the city in a lot of different capacities. I led what was then called the Office of Professional Standards, which was at that time embedded in the police department, and we had investigated police-involved shootings and allegations of officer misconduct. I was the general counsel and chief of staff for the city's 911 center. And then at my last full-time job at the city I was the interim first deputy as part of an interim management team that went in to really try to fix broken business practices and the MBE-WBE program in the city of Chicago. So I've had senior executive roles in a number of big, complicated organizations within the city.
Let me also...
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Well, go ahead. You might get to the point, because, well, I'll tell you what. I'll let you go ahead and tell me about more recently what you did, but I want you to include in that bit of the bio the fact that, you know, you took some heat for this, so let's get it cleared up. Mayor Emanuel offered you a position. You can mention what it was. You said yes. I believe you sort of clarified you didn't plan to run for mayor, and then you've had certain aldermen like Nick Sposato and others going after you just saying that wasn't the right thing to do. So as you finish that more recent bio, please include that part of the story.
Yeah, sure. So more recently, I served for almost 3 years as the president of the police board. And as you mentioned, I was reappointed by the mayor last August. And frankly, he asked me point blank at that time if I was currently running for mayor. And I wasn't. I had no intentions at that time to run for mayor. But I will also say that I also served as the co-chair of the Police Accountability Task Force, which took a very deep dive, not only into the police department, but other parts of the local policing infrastructure, and released a very detailed report of findings and recommendations in April 16. But let me say this about my friend, Alderman Sposato. When people decide that they're going to serve in any capacity in government, and I was in an appointed position, at least for me, my view was I served the public, and I served the public with integrity and independence, particularly in those very sensitive roles. I did not give, nor was I asked to, because I would not have, given some kind of loyalty oath to the mayor. We're not in a fiefdom. We're not in some kind of Soviet style of government. And loyalty oaths of public employees, public servants, is really antithetical to participatory democracy. So Mr. Sposato, with due respect, has completely missed the mark. I'm not owned by Rahm Emanuel. Rahm Emanuel didn't create me. He didn't make my career. He called upon me to serve because of my background and experience that I could add to the positions that I served and led. So I think this nonsense where Mr. Alderman Sposato is asking everybody to take a pledge that they're not going to run for office misses the mark. I'd rather, frankly, that he focus on actually doing his job and providing needed oversight of city government rather than a brazen attempt to curry favor with the mayor because he wanted to be the aviation chair.
So, and again, I'm just going to put a fine button on this, which is to say, so when the mayor, then when you were asked by the mayor or staffing, you know, are you running for mayor, the way you just worded it, are you running for mayor, you said no. Are you saying at the time you made this decision that it was not in your mind that you might run for mayor, you could run for mayor? Was there anything you kept from the mayor and his staff about that at the time, whether you should or shouldn't have, but was there anything you kept from him?
No, I started thinking about this reality late last year, early the beginning of this year, but frankly, because I feel like the mayor has failed. I feel like the mayor has not taken on some of the big systemic challenges because it's not politically expedient for him to do so. You know, I envision a city where we don't have 40% of African-American children living in poverty. I envision a city where we don't have neighborhood after neighborhood that looks like a wasteland, something that isn't even of this world, let alone in our same city of Chicago. I envision a city where we don't have neighborhood after neighborhood where the unemployment rate is routinely at 25% or more, and that, of course, doesn't include the people who have just stopped looking for work because there's no real opportunities there. We have to have a mayor who is a mayor for the entire city, who sees people, who hears people, who's willing to listen. I can't tell you how many times I get thanked by people just for being present and listening. And that's the kind of mayor that I will be, but that's not the kind of mayor that we have right now. We need to have a government that is far more responsive to the needs of people in the neighborhoods.
I do want to get into the issues. Obviously, that's the purpose of this interview. A question about money, which is, you know, Rahm Emanuel, you ain't ever going to touch the money he's got. You can add up all the money that, of all the candidates, and maybe except Willie Wilson, with personal funds, but it's going to be really tough for any of you to reach the amounts that he has available to him and probably will have available to him. Yet I did start off this interview saying you're the one to watch, and that's not my evaluation solely. I've had several people, including, I will tell you, some aldermen, who have said to me, you watch her. So that's why I said that. But financially, will you be able to compete? I know you're going to say yes, but I mean, realistically now, you'll never reach Rahm's money.
Well, I don't think you need to reach Rahm's money. Rahm had $25 million that he spent against Chuy Garcia that barely limped over the finish line first. I expect him not to make that mistake this time. I think he's going to have probably $40 million available to him. At the last quarter in, his average contributions were almost $25,000, average single contribution. Nobody's going to need that kind of money, and frankly, I think it's a turnoff for people to feel like the only way that they can participate in government is to be a millionaire or a billionaire. Will we have enough money to be able to get our message out, to reach people, to have an effective field operation, and, of course, be on TV in this very expensive market? I don't have any doubt about that. But no one needs Rahm's money, and frankly, maybe he does need that much money, because you're going to have to buy a lot of sweaters to change around the fact that he is has been stuck in a low 30% approval rating. And of the people that we surveyed, over 60% of the folks said the city's going in the wrong direction and they are looking for a new leader. So the challenge and the opportunity, obviously, is for me to persuade those people where that huge hunger for change all across the city that I'm the candidate of choice. And I think that the way that this race is shaping up so far, people recognize that I'm the real contender to challenge Rahm Emanuel and to beat him.
I had the pleasure of working with you and most of all the other mayoral candidates a while back at the Independent Voters debate. Mm-hmm. It was a fun mm-hmm. night, wasn't it?
I
hope you had some dinner. They started us and called me up right when they were about to serve the main course. I got nothing. But anyway, although I did take something home, I will tell you that. But when I saw that group up there, there's probably some serious contenders, some not. But, you know, mm-hmm. you're up against a Paul Vallis, a Gary McCarthy. People feel differently about him. Is there anybody in that current group you look at and say, look, this is a serious, not to take anybody down, I'm not after that, but somebody you look mm-hmm. and say, look, here's somebody, this is qualified. This is a real race. This is a meaningful race to take a look at these particular candidates. Here's why I should win.
Look, it's always a danger when you start naming names, right? But clearly there are people in the race, and Paul and Gary, I think, are, and particularly Paul, has a breadth of experience and is a serious candidate. I think that the reason that there are so many people in this race is because they see a great need and an opportunity for victory for the reasons that I've outlined. And Rahm Emanuel is in serious trouble, and I think it's going to be very, very difficult for him to get a third term, and I intend to do everything possible to make that happen. But I do think that it's healthy for our city and healthy for our democracy to have so many different voices in that bring different perspectives on a range of different issues, different life experiences. I think that's a good thing for our city. You know as well as I do that all the people who raised their hand and said, I'm going to run for mayor, are not going to be on the ballot. It's very difficult to get on the ballot in the city. It's kind of the Chicago way. You need 12,500 valid signatures. As a voter, you can only sign a single petition. If you sign multiple petitions, your subsequent signatures are invalidated. So that requires a lot of infrastructure. And there aren't a lot of people that are running now that really have the bandwidth to make that happen. So I think at last count there may be 11 people that are running. There's no chance that all 11 of those people are going to make it on the ballot. I think there's going to be a small handful of us who get over that, you know, important threshold. Yeah. And then we're going to have a robust and, I hope, interesting debate about ideas.
All right, let's turn to those ideas. You know, if I were to ask people what's the most important topic to talk about with you, I think they would split between violence in the city, police accountability, that being one topic, education being a second topic. Yep. But I'm going to go to the pocketbook first. Because I got to tell you, I live in the city. My property taxes are through the roof. I'm being nickel and dimed with fees. I can't go to I walk out of stores, literally bananas hanging from my hands because I will not pay 7 cents for a bag. You know, but on the other hand, to give Rahm Emanuel credit, he did inherit a financial mess. He did. And by the way, recent reports indicating he actually starts the new year with less debt, the smallest since 2008 at $97.9 million. Still a dangerous number, but nevertheless, you know, that he, by doing what he's done in terms of taxes, whatever, he's getting a bit of a hold on the on that overall debt. What kind of grade do you give him for handling it, and what would you do differently to get a handle on it without killing me with fees and taxes?
Yeah. Well, look, the forecast that came out yesterday, I think it was, leaves a lot of important big numbers off the table. It doesn't account for the cost that's going to be substantial for implementing the consent decree. It doesn't include the full cost of additional hiring of police. And there's other costs that are left off the table. And frankly, it doesn't include an answer, which I think is going to be critically important as part of this discussion, on what to do to reach that 2020 deadline to provide a substantial amount of resources to get to fully funding our pension debt. So, yeah, there's been progress that was made, no question, but there's still a lot that we don't know and a lot of answers to questions that he is not offering up. Now, to get to, I think, the question of revenue, because we're going to have to get there, but first we've got to convince people that we're getting our fiscal house in order. You know, I think that a lot of people across the city feel like we've these regressive taxes that fall disproportionately on low-income and middle-income folks are driving people out of the city. I don't think there's any question about that. We have taxed and levied and fined our way into oblivion, and frankly, a number of different studies have come out that black and Latino neighborhoods and low-income neighborhoods in general, those taxes and levies and fees are falling disproportionately. They're getting ticketed more heavily. They're seeing red light ticket fines, and all the other kind of administrative fines that the city can levy seem to be falling disproportionately into certain neighborhoods. So that's something we've obviously got to get addressed right away. But more globally, we are wasting way too much money. Every single year, we blow through the budget for settlements, judgments, and attorney's fees. And it's not just with the police department, which is really outrageous.
Yeah.
In the last 7 years, we spent $500 million in settlements, judgments, and attorney's fees. And yet there doesn't seem to be any sense of urgency around that. I don't understand that. Why is it that we are a $10 billion enterprise and we have no serious risk management function? We have nobody who's employed by the city of Chicago whose job it is to identify and mitigate waste. That's crazy. And that's why we see so much that's happening from city finances. It's out of control. Just to give you one data point, this year the city budgeted $40 million for settlements and judgments against the city. We got to that number by June 30th. So every day after June 30th, we're blowing through a budget. Now, either we didn't figure it out, because we're just in the police department alone, we're averaging over the last few years $50 to $60 million. And, of course, that doesn't include the blockbuster cases where somebody's been wrongfully incarcerated for decades. But we have to have smarter, better fiscal management. We cannot talk to people about revenue until we convince them that we've gotten our fiscal house in order. And right now, we have a long way to go because we are not operating city government in the most efficient way that we possibly can.
Let me help you bridge that answer to the notion of police accountability and the violence issues in the city at all. It's such a large topic. But you're right. I pick up the paper every day and I read about another, you know, $5 million settlement with some family whose, you know, family member's been killed and whatever. And I understand. Yep. I'm a lawyer as well as you. I even teach the bar review course. I get this stuff. But the point is that a settlement doesn't mean guilt or anything else. It means what it means.
Of course.
Case is settled. But you pick up the paper and you read about millions and millions and millions, or as you say, $500 million in some of these settlements. And to me, you have to take a step back and say, how did we get here in the first place in terms of these events that have happened? That, to me, is the police accountability issue. That is the realm in which you worked for so many years for this city. So talk about that and what you would do. Got Laquan McDonald going on right now. What do you do to get a handle on this?
Well, I think, first of all, you got to ask exactly the questions that you just laid out on the table, which are exactly the right ones. There's got to be a sense of urgency around this. When we have the amount of money that's going out the door every year that we have to go into the bond market and we have to borrow at our terrible, with our terrible credit rating, which means we're going to pay double or triple that amount on the long term if it's not restructured. Somebody's got to ask the question, what is going on? We have 400 to 500 cases on any given day pending against the city of Chicago and individual police officers. We can't just fluff that off and say opportunistic plaintiff's lawyers or just a few bad apples. That volume, which dwarfs other cities across the country, on the amount of money that we're spending on a per capita basis, I think if we're not one, we're two. That can't just be relegated to, well, that's just the cost of doing business. That's always going to happen. No, this is so out of the norm that we have got to ask questions like, is this a training problem? Is this something that's related to supervision? Is it a tactics problem? Is it something related to a particular unit? Or are there specific officers that are having problems? The basic questions are not being asked. If you had a business and you were hemorrhaging money in the way that the city of Chicago is related to a particular unit, you would ask those kinds of questions and you would put a plan in place to get that under control. We're not doing that in the city of Chicago. That's why I've said we got to have a risk manager. The city's inspector general recommended that over a year ago, and it fell on deaf ears. There are things that we can do to make this city work more efficiently. And as you said, this really isn't just a dollars and cents issue, but it is. The other part of it is when individual citizens see that kind of money going out the door and no sense of urgency around it, it delegitimizes the police. Because what individual citizens say, and I hear this all the time, is there no accountability? If I did something wrong, I'm going to be held accountable. Why aren't police officers being held accountable? The truth is there is an accountability structure that happens, but when you see those eye-poppingly large numbers on a regular basis and it keeps going up year after year, it undermines the credibility of those officers who are out there every single day putting their lives on the line for us.
But as you know earlier, the consent decree was announced by Attorney General Lisa Madigan, Rahm Emanuel. So we are doing this interview after that got announced. What is your sense of that consent decree, and does that open the door for some of the resolution?
I think it absolutely does open the door for it. And I was very clear that I am incredibly appreciative of Lisa Madigan for really stepping into the void that was left by the Trump Sessions Department of Justice. They abandoned cities and refused to look at systemic problems in police departments. So the Attorney General Madigan really deserves an enormous amount of credit for stepping into that void. There are a couple of things in that consent decree that I think are really, really transformative. For example, now the CIT, crisis intervention, isn't just going to be a training module. It's going to be a full-fledged program within the department that it, with elevated status. I think that's critically important.
It's expensive, also, too.
Yes and no, right? If you think about the case of Quintonio LeGreer and Betty Jones, we paid, I think, $10 million to Betty Jones' family.
Yep.
Who knows what the resolution is ultimately going to be with the Quintonio LeGreer case. But that's expensive. And those were mistakes that were made. There was officers who were dispatched who were not properly trained to deal with people who were suffering a mental health crisis, and it resulted in tragic consequences. That's not only a dollar and cents issue. Again, that delegitimizes the police department and sets back efforts to try to bridge the gap between the community and the police that they serve. So having a well-trained, CIT-informed group of officers on every shift, every day, being available to respond to these crises are critically important. Now, as an aside, our police should not be the mental health safety net. So we have to rebuild community-based mental health resources, and that's a whole other issue, frankly, that is not addressed by the consent decree. Another good part of the consent decree that I think also will be really transformative is we're finally getting serious about officer wellness. We've had a number of officer suicides already this year. Officers see on a daily basis unbelievable trauma, and their job is, to put it mildly, very, very stressful. Right now, we only have three counselors that are available for a 12,000-member sworn police force. That's way too many, way too few. So we've got to have more resources there. And this consent decree really lays the foundation for that. But despite those good things, and I think there are many, I have some concerns that I articulated about the consent decree, and I'll go through a couple of them. I think we have to extend the comment period from 21 days to 45 days. I spent about 15 hours going through that document, all told, taking copious notes on a paragraph-by-paragraph basis. Now, I'm somebody who's very conversant in the issues that are memorialized in that consent decree. For the average person, they're not going to be able to take that kind of time. And neither the parties to the lawsuit, either the city or the attorney general, have provided for any kind of public education about the ins and outs of that consent decree. That's going to fall on third parties, probably ACLU, Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights, and other lawyers groups. But they are going to need time themselves to digest the document, put together some education materials, and then really go out into the community and do that one-on-one or group engagement. That can't be done in 21 days. So it's really important that that period for public comment get extended. Three other things that are concerning to me in particular. The document allows for chokeholds. We should ban chokeholds. There's nothing good that comes from an officer putting his or her arm around the neck of some person to try to subdue them, you know, a la Eric Garner. The document says the chokeholds are allowed unless there's an intent to do harm. Well, there's no officer who's going to say, I intended to harm this person by this chokehold. And frankly, genuinely, most officers probably aren't trying to actually cause somebody harm when they're getting him in a chokehold. But we know that chokeholds can lead to deadly consequences. We should ban them. Number two, foot pursuits. We saw the video that was released recently of Maurice Granton, who was chased by the police, discarded his firearm, kept running, and then got shot in the back as he was trying to scale a fence. That's a foot chase. Those kinds of chases go on literally every single day. The Department of Justice said this is a problem. The Chicago Police Department doesn't have a specific foot chase policy and isn't training officers on how to engage in those foot chases in a way that doesn't harm the innocent bystanders, the person they're chasing, or frankly themselves. The draft consent decree says, well, let's wait 3 years to January of 2021, and if the monitor thinks that there's a need for a foot pursuit policy, then the department will be obligated to do one in 6 months. That's nonsense. We know we have this need. It was diagnosed by the Department of Justice. We need to have a foot chase policy now. And the last thing is shooting in the crowds, using a firearm to shoot in the crowds. For some reason, the draft consent decree doesn't include the language from the police department's own general orders on use of force that bans shooting into crowds. This is, again, the Betty Jones situation. We should follow the directive that's already been vetted by the Department of Justice and is memorialized in the police department's use of force order regarding shooting into crowds. Stepping back from that, though, there's a number of undefined and ambiguous terms throughout the document. Fundamentally, and you can appreciate this as a lawyer, a consent decree is a set of obligations taken on by the municipality with specific timelines to get the job done. Then you have a monitor, and the monitor audits and then makes an assessment as to whether or not the municipality is making substantial progress. That's the buzzword, substantial compliance, towards meeting those obligations. And then there's court oversight. But where the document is most important is what are the specific obligations that the city and the police department are agreeing to.
All right, well,
issues. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. Well, we have only a couple minutes left, and I want to, if I can, because you've got, I know it's a very important area to use, and I didn't want to interrupt you. Can I do a lightning round with you of just a few things?
Absolutely.
A couple of quick questions. So just in no particular order, but legalizing pot, should we?
Yes, I think so. There's overwhelming support for legalization of marijuana. I just want to make sure that we learn the lessons from other states that have legalized marijuana so we don't fall down and make mistakes that other states have made, that we use best practices there. We obviously also have to do everything we can to keep marijuana in the hands of our kids, and we have to look creatively at ways in which we make entrepreneurs from those communities that have been most ravaged by the war on drugs.
Red light cameras, speed light, speed cameras, are those revenue sources, safety issue, safety devices? Would you expand them, hate them? What's your feeling?
Well, I do hate them, like probably any motorist. Red light cameras are kind of the scourge, but they're clearly a revenue-generating issue. They're not for safety. So we have not handled that program well. We had somebody who obviously was a criminal and had was giving inside information to the company that had the contract. They're all gone now. But we've got to think about whether or not this is a needed revenue source. This administration didn't give people due process and ended up paying out $39.5 million in the settlement to a plaintiff's lawyer who saw that the ticketing process wasn't functioning the way it was supposed to under law. So that's a program that has to get a lot more scrutiny. If we're going to keep it, then we need to get it right.
Term limits, you support them, and if they don't exist, Pat Quinn's trying to bring them around to affect even Rahm if it should happen. But do you support them? Would you impose them on yourself?
Yeah, I always have supported term limits, and of course I would abide by them. I think two terms is plenty.
Elected school board.
I'm supported. My mother was on an elected school board in my town, and I saw firsthand how having a parent advocate having a seat at the table was critically important to giving a voice to average citizens who cared about their kids' education.
And finally, you know, listen, you would be a lot of firsts if you would if you were elected mm-hmm. mayor. We've had a female mayor. People remember Jane Byrne. But you'd be the first African-American elected female mayor, the first openly gay. You've got your spouse, Amy, your kid. If there's anybody out there in the city, I mean, I think Chicago's a pretty progressive city, whatever. But that doesn't mean there aren't people yeah. with concerns and issues out there. So if anybody was at all concerned about having be it an African-American female, openly gay, whatever it is, what would you like to say about what makes you the best mayor from that personal life standpoint?
Well, because I think I have lived the life of many Chicagoans across the city. I know what it feels like to struggle. I know what it feels like to be denied opportunities simply because gender, race. And I know what it feels like to be denied other kinds of opportunities. I don't want our kids to be lucky. I want them to be surrounded with all sorts of opportunities so they can see an image of themselves that is bigger than their current circumstance. And that's the kind of mayor that I'm going to be. I'm going to be one who is visible and present in every neighborhood, and we're making progress. We've already covered 40 different neighborhoods across the city. But fundamentally, I'm going to be a mayor who listens and brings people together to take on and solve tough challenges.
For people that want to learn more about your campaign, donate to you and all that, give them your website.
You can go to lightfootforchicago.com, and we're very active on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
Lori Lightfoot, I sure appreciate your time, your candor. You answered every question and without hesitation, and I sure appreciate all of that. And, we're going to talk again, I hope.
I hope so. Thanks so much, Paul. I really appreciated our conversation.
I appreciate you. Thanks so much. Talk to you soon.
All right, take care.
Lori Lightfoot, candidate for mayor, one to consider among the many who are running. But now you know more about her. And now let's take a turn from mayoral politics over to the world of theater, which you know I love. And a really, first of all, a unique guy, but also a man who's devoted his career to making a difference, in my opinion, in the city of Chicago when it comes to gay and lesbian theater. And really putting it on the map many years ago, 30 years ago, really, if you start to do the math, even longer than that ago. But we're going to focus in on the work of David Zack, who is the executive director of the current, we're going to talk about Pride Fest, we're going to talk about upcoming shows, but he is the current director of Pride Films and Plays. I've known him forever and a day, including back when he created the Bailiwick Theater Company many years ago, and we want to talk about what's coming up. David, just a remarkable career. One day we'll just do a retrospective on you, but for today we're just going to look ahead for a few months, if that's okay.
That sounds fantastic. Thanks, Paul.
And joining David and myself, Kevin Brovsky, he's a playwright, making a Chicago debut with a play coming up very soon called Hurricane Damage, which we'll be playing as part of a fest over at Pride Films and Plays. And he's done some amazing work himself all over the country and all over the world, actually. So we're going to get to have him join this conversation as well. Kevin, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
All right, as our WGN listeners listen in, I want to start with a general question, David, if I can, before we kind of turn to the season, because you've devoted your life to this notion of LGBTQ theater from back in the early days. It's come a long way. I'm going to ask you both this question, but David, talk to me about how LGBTQ theater has changed from when you first started in this world on this issue, where things are today, and why it is still important today to focus in on the work of the community.
I think it's changed a lot, not always for the best, but you know, there's a lot of really great things happening. I think in general, the theater world really misses the whole off-Broadway scene, which was for many, many years the sort of wellspring from which all the gay plays wrote and all the great gay guys, you know, Albie and McNally and Larry Kramer and all that sort of stuff. So that's changed because, you know, Broadway is as gay as it gets right now. So if you want to go see a gay play, you know, it's $100 and it's a big musical or Kinky Boots or Boys in the Band or any of that sort of stuff. So things have changed. I don't think, you know, at the storefront level, I think people are really continuing to push the boundaries of exploring gender, of really trying to understand the nature of relationships, trying to understand, you know, the more complicated issues that you can still dig into when you're in a storefront theater that you can't do in a big Broadway show. So I think there'll always be a place for people to get together and sort of have an experience in a theater that you can't get when you're in a watching television, or that you can't get when you're in a movie theater. And frankly, I think people, because of the times that we are in, you know, there are a lot of uncertainties for the LGBT community right now. So I think in some ways it's more important than ever that people really understand where they can go to sort of channel their energy and figure out how to respond to the various forces which are pushing back against a lot of the freedoms that I think the LGBT community had felt that they had earned over the last decade or so.
And feel it being pulled away. And by the way, Pride's Arts Center, which is up at 4147 North Broadway, intimate space, all the theaters you've worked, David, when I think about it, are sort of intimate spaces, which brings the audience in very close to what's going on. I imagine that's kind of important to the work you want. You want that relationship with the audience.
Yeah, I think the audiences really enjoy the fact that they're close, that they're able, whether it's Priscilla or, you know, a big musical or something like Hurricane Damage, which is a really beautiful, intimate piece for older actors. You love that sense of being right on top of things, and I think it has a whole different experience than when you're in, you know, the third balcony of Hamilton or something.
Yeah.
You know, also a great experience, but this is just a whole different thing.
It's a little different and a little less ticket price. Kevin, this play, which David just kind of triggered there, Hurricane Damage, you do, like, it's sort of interesting, as David just gave us a bit of the history of LGBTQ theater. This is a play that takes a look at a couple of who are now older guys who lived through the 70s and you know, the gay life back then as things are now. So in many ways, this play is kind of representative of the change through the decades.
Yes, this play deals with a gay couple who decided in the late 80s to move to Florida to basically escape the AIDS epidemic in New York, and now they are dealing with other issues of age and the end of life, and they're questioning, you know, what did we go through all of that back in the 80s just for this? So,
by the way, when you say just for this, what do you mean? Because it sounds like was it all worth it? Is that the question you're asking?
Was it all worth it? I mean, getting older, facing death, and just the fear of that, being sick with other things other than AIDS, and. The dreams that you have in youth, which did not happen.
Yeah, it was a different life. David, this play is going to, it's running August 1st through August 26th. It's running in rep with a show called Holding the Man by Tommy Murphy.
Mm-hmm.
Talk to me about because I imagine it was your decision to say, I want these two shows to run in repertory. Holding the Man, which is, again, about a couple in a long-term relationship. Was that the theme here?
Yeah, I think so. We do a lot of stuff that is historical in nature here at Pride Films and Plays, so doing things like The Nance or things that, you know, that have happened in history. We think it's extremely important for everyone, you know, not just the community, but our friends and allies, to know the history of the community. And then with new writers, we can build a bridge to the future with a lot of the new stuff that we're doing, which is more trans oriented or gender balanced, all that sort of stuff. I like these two plays because they both have very clever devices. In Hurricane Damage, there's a third character. Well, there's four characters. Who's the fourth one's cute and adorable, and you can't have a gay play without somebody who doesn't have a shirt on. But the third character is Tom Chiola, who many people know as one of the judges here in Chicago. And
he was. He's retired, but he was an actual judge. Yeah.
Yeah, he's an actual judge, and his character is somebody who stayed single all this time. So the contrast between the older couple and who have been coupled forever, you know, and it's very, very funny, you know, very, very funny, you know, sort of like odd couple kind of funny dialogue. And the contrast between the two of them and the guy who's been single, traveling around the world, shooting photos for National Geographic and, you know, shooting men's erotica and stuff. It's really fun. And I think there's a lot of people today who will be, you know, which side are we on? Are we in the single side, and are we in the duo side? And that's one of the things that I really like about this play. There are not, you know, because of what happened in the 80s, there are not plays about older gay
yeah.
men. You know, and we see from our own subscriber base that people want to see their own lives on stage. And for a long time, you know, you just didn't have anything. So when I got this play from Kevin, it really made me think, oh, not only is it a great opportunity for Danny Taylor, who played Tennessee Williams for us last year, it's a great opportunity for Chuck Berglund, who's a member of the Jeff Committee, and a lot of people know for his decades as a high school teacher, and for Tom, you know, those three roles are great. On the other hand, Tommy Murphy, you know, has taken Holding the Man, which is probably one of the most famous properties in Australian literature. It's very much a true story about two guys who were devoted, sort of a Romeo and Romeo, you know, kind of, you know, tragic story that encompasses some of the same time period, but with two younger actors. And his, you know, using storytelling, all sorts of storytelling techniques, it spans you know, the lifetime of these two characters from when they met in school until the end. So it's very romantic, and it's very beautiful. And Michael Graham is the director for that piece, and has really done a great job on you know, and yeah. not only in a small space, but also in a small space sharing the set with another show, bringing that full tale to life. And it's fun to, you know, the Australian Embassy has been a big help with us in terms of promoting the show. Because it's so well known, you know, there is a movie version of it which is out, but, you know, the movie version, which you can see on Netflix, is a whole different thing from seeing it in live and in person.
Oh, as everything
we're happy
is.
To be able to bring that play to Chicago as well.
Yeah. By the way, Ken, I'm going to walk through the new season with you, David, because the Hurricane Damage, Holding the Man, the final part of what has been the PAC Pride Fest series going on. Then we'll turn to the new season. But, Kevin, when I think about new works being premiered in Chicago, and I've had this conversation with Jerry Mitchell, who produces so many of his shows, directs so many of his new shows here. He's not alone. Jeffrey Seller, you know, so many shows start in Chicago. Here you are making your debut here. What sense do you get that why do playwrights want to see their work premiered in Chicago before it, or even if it's going to go to Broadway, before it goes to Broadway?
I believe you can say Steppenwolf. When in New York we think of Chicago, we think of Steppenwolf.
True.
And I know there's a lot more than that.
I think of David Zack, but go ahead.
I know there's a lot of more, but we almost think of Chicago as a place where serious theater comes from. So when I was offered a chance to be a part of that with Hurricane Damage, beyond thrilled. Means a lot to me. And everyone I talk to, I'm having a play down in Chicago. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
That's great.
Well, and what people like the Jerry Mitchells say and the Jeffrey Sellers, we're very critical audiences here, David, right? You know, if you're going to bring a play or move it on and other things or take it to festivals as you do, you know you're going to get the kind of reaction you need to sharpen a play here in Chicago.
Absolutely. And so it's a sophisticated audience. It knows what it's seen, and it knows what it likes. And so we're here to celebrate that. And we're here to, you know, through a whole year-round worth of programming, I think we're in a really unique spot where we can do new things almost, you know, within every month. There's always a new film festival or a cabaret show or something else that we feel is really a part of the neighborhood that we are a part of here in Uptown and in the Buena Park neighborhood. So it's exciting to be able to see things and also, you know, see things that are important for everybody to see. It's not, you know, like I think for a while people thought, oh, gay theater is just sort of a subculture. And what we realized from other places, you know, that have really specific niches in the theater market, you know, Jackie Taylor and Black Ensemble, that's for everybody.
Yeah.
You know, everybody should go. There's no reason why we should all not be trotting out to see that. And I think a lot of people feel that way about Pride Films and Plays, seeing some of the musicals we've had, seeing, you know, it's fun because you might be sitting next to a drag queen while you're in your business suit, but that's the way we think the world should be.
Listen,
and hopefully the world will be.
I went to see Heartbreak Hotel and sat with two Elvises, so I mean it's it's all over the place. Hey, David, let me do a lightning round of walking through the new season with you because I want to get it all in the time we have. So if you can, just give me kind of brief descriptions, and we'll send people to the website to get more information but also the specific play dates for these. But as your new 2018-19 season starts, five shows, so people, one world premiere among them, by the way, people can get tickets for the whole season. But it starts for the month of September, basically, with Homos Are Everyone in America by Jordan Seavey. What is that about?
It's a really fun piece. It's about a couple that has in a sort of broken up sort of situation. You see them on their first date. You see them fall in love. You see a couple of their friends, and it's very much a slice of life of New York today. And it's really, really, really fascinating and well constructed.
Followed by for the month of actually October into November, It's Only a Play by Terry. You called him Terry McNally. I don't know him that well, but
well,
but Terrence McNally.
One of the from him. So
yeah. Any signs of Terry? Well, let's call him Terry.
So we love that play. You know, it's a new version of what he did a couple seasons ago on Broadway. So we don't have the Broadway stars, but we sure have the Broadway attitude. Don Martinez is the director of that, and we're really excited to see what he does. It's a really funny play about a group of performers who are celebrating the opening night of a Broadway show and all the drama and comedy that brings.
And John Martinez, by the way, choreographed Priscilla for you, right?
He did, yeah. And it's a lot of, you know, done a lot of great things as a director / choreographer and really upcoming in the city.
And by the way, I should know, because when I think of Priscilla, what goes immediately through my mind are two things. I'm off the script here for a second, but as I say, when I think of all the awards that your shows are winning, which of course is a testament to your work as a director and all that you do and select, but in addition, even in your casting, and Kevin, I'm sure you have a sense of this too, but you know, you cast trans actors. You're very conscious. You know, Hamilton, when I talked to them and talked about they're sort of being colorblind in their casting, they said, no, we're color intensive. They rejected the term colorblind.
Right.
And I feel as though you are orientation intensive, to use that, in your casting, to make sure you have representation of every community.
Right. And we like that in our season as well. So the play that's coming up in January is a really great lesbian play, a sort of period kind of bodice ripper called I Know My Own Heart by Emma Donahue. Emma Donahue wrote Room, which is that great movie.
Oh yeah,
that you know, about the kid and the kid and the woman trapped in the,
won an Academy Award.
Yeah, and you know, amazing, amazing writer. And so Elizabeth Swanson is directing that, and it's really very sexy and powerful. And then that's followed right away by Southern Comfort, which is a musical. Speaking of being, you know, off the radar screen,
yeah.
Southern Comfort was done at the Public Theater, and is a story of a trans community. Which is sort of assembling a family, choosing your own family, which is the theme for our season this year, is who are we? How do we find our, you know, the family members that we are really related to, as opposed to the family members that we're just, you know, share blood with. So Southern Comfort is a beautiful work by the team of people that wrote Trevor, which was a big hit last year for Writers Theater.
That was up and running. Yeah, it was by Dan Collins and Julian Wick Davis, and that, I know their hope is that goes to Broadway. We'll see. It was certainly well done up at Writers. But Southern Comfort, I mean, this is not a new show. This has been around for a while, right? So this is kind of bringing something back. Is there hopes?
Well, it was based on a documentary, yeah, which came out about 10 years ago. So the musical is very new.
Ah, okay.
I
gotcha.
Think it was in maybe 2016 at the Public. And the challenge, of course, is in Chicago, We would do what they didn't do in New York. In New York, they were using cisgendered actors to play the trans characters, and you can't get away with that in Chicago anymore.
Right.
So that's been really exciting to figure out, you know, who in the city is a singer, who in the city, you know, it's a whole different thing when you're dealing with trans performers and figuring out how they choose their life's work, how vocal ranges change, how singing changes, how hormones, you know, impact your vocal performance. It's fascinating, you know, and it's different for everybody. It's a brand new science for everybody. And you're seeing a lot of kids who are coming out of school, places like Roosevelt, places like Northwestern, kids who really are very comfortable in being trans or being queer, being non-binary, or being any of the things that people talk about these days. The challenge is finding folks who are in their 40s or older who are trans performers and good enough to sing Broadway shows. So we're looking for people. If anybody listening here is, you know, would like to submit the name of somebody who they know is a wonderful singer and is part of the trans community, we'd love to see them, because we're seeing everybody.
And you got to build up. And listen, the season's going to close off with Desire in a Tiny House. This looks really interesting. Well, go ahead and describe it. I mean, it's talk about living in the middle of the woods. Go ahead.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's Nelson Rodriguez is directing this piece. Nelson's been our artistic director for the last couple seasons, so he loves this. It's a very small story about two men who have a really intense and very passionate relationship, you know, as the world goes to hell around them, basically. So it's funny, it's sexy, it's really, really interesting. Again, it's very appropriate for the stuff that people are feeling as we go through the day-to-day news cycles of what the hell's happening,
what's going on
in the world.
Yep. The website is pridefilmsandplays.com, pridefilmsandplays.com. And, David, I know that I was at the theater the other night. You talk about season subscriptions, obviously. And this is important. Look, there are a lot of theater lovers in the city. It's why I call this podcast Behind the Curtain. People love theater here. And as you just said, you know, even when Black Ensemble started, it might have been thought of as a theater that, you know, the African-Americans should go to. And, of course, now I've been going there for years, and you see the audience is filled with everybody and everything. Same thing with your audiences. If you love theater, you need to check it out. Talk about the season subscription for people that want to check it out.
Well, we have a deal going right now. People want to jump on this for the next week. We're doing $75 subscriptions for the 5-show season. So
wow.
you have to use the code 75reasons. But if you get onto the website in the next week or so, that's a code that only people who are coming to the theater are getting. But I'm sharing that with your people, because they are so cool. So
yeah,
if you go onto the website page and look for the subscription and packages page, just use the code 75reasons, and you can get a ticket for a subscription for $75, which is a great deal.
Never.
You get reserved seats. You're right up close. And choose your own performance, whatever day of the week you want to come. It's a very, very sweet deal.
Kevin, tell me what impresses you about David Zach and the work of and his work here that made you say, I want to work with this team. You talked about Steppenwolf, whatever, but obviously you picked this venue to bring this show.
Well, listen to him. He knows exactly what he's talking about. He knows exactly what he's doing. This is the most organized place I've ever been involved with. I got reports daily. I'm not used to it. It was shocking to me. Yeah, we do a lot of theater in New York, and some things fall through the cracks. That has not happened here.
Well,
yeah.
Well, there it is, David. Nothing falls through the cracks. There's kind of a motto for you. Nothing will fall through the cracks.
That could be, you know, in Chicago theater, that could be that could be the name of a new company.
That could be critical. But for now, let's go with the existing company, Pride Films and Plays. And again, the website, pridefilmsandplays.com. The code, I'm going to say it again. Instead of paying $96 for the entire season, which is cheap anyway, by the way, if you see theater, 75 reasons as the code will get you that season for $75. That's almost unheard of in this city. For the 5 shows. David Zach, you're an amazing treasure. I imagine one day there's going to be some life-size statue of you built somewhere in this city. And Kevin Brofsky, you'll be there when they dedicate that statue, I'm sure, of David.
I hope so.
playwright for Hurricane Damage. I wish you luck as we all wait for Hurricane Damage to open very soon over at the theater, and I know I'll be there for that and there for all the shows that you do. Gentlemen, thank you so much for your time, for your insight, for the, David, for the great work you do, and Kevin, for the great work you do. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Paul.
All right. Thank you, Paul. Well, if you want to know more about what we've talked about here, follow me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, at Paul Lisnek. That's P-A-U-L-L-I-S-N-E-K. And I'd love to hear your comments or topic suggestions for future podcasts. You can also go to my website, paullisnek.tv. And hey, don't forget to hit subscribe on WGN Plus and iTunes. And tune in each week to hear more Insider Scoop coming to you from behind the curtain.